case?
Please, the court, I'm not often starting on this side. Let me just...
Need to stop the clock a minute, please.
Good morning. May it please the court, Robert Anderson for the Commonwealth in this appeal. This is a case where we each lost, and partly won, partly lost in the Court of Appeals. We each appealing the part that we lost on. The court's taken both appeals, so everything is before the court. Just at the outset, I would note there's been several recent decisions where this court has dealt with assignments of error, and whether they were adequate or not, the court's repeatedly made clear, as it's held, that facially adequate assignments of error, necessary mandatory procedural requirement, absent compliance with the rules such as Rule 5A12C1, I think it's too little I, I'm just going to say Rule 5A12C just to expedite the references. An appellate court is deprived of active jurisdiction and the appeal must be dismissed. In the Commonwealth's view, the defendant's assignment of error in the Court of Appeals in this case, the one and only assignment of error which challenged all six convictions, was plainly violative of the rule. It was almost word for word what the rule says you can't do. The defendant's brief as appellee in the immediate appeal does not once say that that language was sufficient. He makes an argument that, pointing to where in the record the item, the order at issue was made, cures any issue in the language, which I submit is incorrect under the language of the rule. And yet, despite what I think was palpably an inadequate assignment of error in the Court of Appeals with basically very little in the way of explanation or justification reached the merits of the case and affirmed two convictions, reversed four. We submit this was error. The court should reverse. If somehow the court is to get to the sufficiency of the evidence on the six convictions, then obviously we're asking the court to affirm on the attempted murder firearm counts and reverse on the four abduction counts. Finally, before I get into particulars, I submit that any other conclusion would strip this explicit prohibition in Rule 5A12C of any meaning. Another way to put it is, if this assignment of error passed muster, it's very difficult to see how one would not. Now, the assignment of error in the Court of Appeals said, quote, the trial court erred by failing to grant the defendant's motion to strike the Commonwealth's evidence as being insufficient as a matter of law to sustain his convictions for attempted murder, abduction, and use of a firearm in the commission of a felony. In the Commonwealth's view, that is plainly deficient under Rule 5A12C, and for that matter, the equivalent provision in this Rule 517, where it says in 5A12C1, too little I, assignment of error which merely states the judgment or award is contrary to the law and the evidence is not sufficient. If the assignments of error are insufficient or otherwise fail to comply with the requirements of this rule, the petition for appeal shall be dismissed. And yet, what I submit is a plain directive to the Court of Appeals, it ignored, and again, with very little in the way of justification.
Mr. Anderson, how do you distinguish, in terms of sufficiency of the assignment of error, the assignment of error in this case and the assignment of error that we said was sufficient in the Finley case.
In which case?
Finley.
Finley, Your Honor, was a case where the, as I recall, the assignment of error said something to the effect the trial court erred in denying the defendant's motions to suppress certain enumerated evidence in a child pornography case, and the court held that that was sufficient. The one big critical difference is there was no rule in Rule 5A12 that dealt with such an assignment. We have an explicit rule in the rule, explicit prohibition in the rule dealing specifically in the context of a claim that the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law. There was no equivalent provision in the rule. And the short answer is, and you know, obviously I take as correct the ruling in Finley, but nevertheless, there was no rule that the court had to confront in Finley equivalent to the rule the court has to confront here. You have this explicit rule saying you can't just simply say in some vague terms the evidence, the judgment is contrary to the law and the evidence, and that is plainly what this defendant did. For that reason alone, I mean, the axiomatic rule of statutory construction, which this is a rule, but it seems to me the same principle, that you give effect, if at all possible, to every word of a provision.
As I recall the argument in Finley, the challenge to the sufficiency turned on the fact that the assignment of error didn't say more, that it didn't say that the court erred in denying the motion to suppress
right.
because, if there wasn't a because, it was wrong. And this assignment of error doesn't have that either.
Well, and that's true. And if you didn't have the rule that I quoted at the outset, specifically giving as an example an assignment of error that is not sufficient, then the case might be controlled by Finley. But you have, it's ultimately an apples and orange situation. Finley had no equivalent rule saying if you say this, it's deficient. In this case, you have a specific rule saying that if all the assertion is that the judgment is contrary to the law and the evidence, that doesn't cut it. There was no equivalent prohibition in Finley, so that would be...
Might the distinction be that the purpose behind it all is to direct the court to the deficiency? And if you have a motion to suppress, suggesting that there's a deficiency there at least points you to where the deficiency is located in a motion to suppress. But when you're having a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence to uphold a conviction, the entire record is at stake.
That's right. And two things, Justice Lemons, in connection with that. You might have a motion to strike that goes on for any number of pages where there are any number of discrete arguments, and sometimes not so discrete, where it's not entirely clear where argument A ends and argument B begins, et cetera, et cetera. But all of that's true, but first and foremost, I go back to the language of the rule. The language of the rule says in very clear, unmistakable language that you cannot do what this defendant did.
In your view, would this assignment of error be sufficient if it said the court erred in not granting the motion to strike because the Commonwealth failed to prove the elements of each of the offenses?
That would certainly come a lot closer to being sufficient.
What does that tell me that the first one doesn't tell me?
Well, the second one doesn't track the language of the explicitly prohibited assignment of error. For example, the assignment...
Counsel, aren't we always going to have this dilemma when it comes to a sufficiency of the evidence question? Because the sufficiency of the evidence essentially is the functional equivalent of saying the dog didn't bark. There's nothing there. And when you're saying there's nothing there, or the dog didn't bark, where in the record can you show me the absence of something?
Your Honor, showing where something is in the record is distinct from the language employed in the assignment of error. Again, absent truly unusual circumstances, this court is duty-bound to give effect to the rule in 5A12C12.
Counsel, do you suggest that the rule is different because for sufficiency than for any other assignment of error?
Well, basically my answer is yes, because there is an explicit rule prohibition dealing with sufficiency of evidence claims. There's no equivalent, for example, in Finley. There was no equivalent rule dealing with, like, pretrial motions. And again, the court...
Have we ever drawn that distinction? Sorry to interrupt you, but have we ever drawn that distinction, saying that there is a separate rule for sufficiency than any other assignment of error?
I think the rule itself draws the distinction.
But have we ever confirmed that, understanding on your part?
Not that anything comes to mind, but in the court has to provide some rationale as to why it says, if the court is to conclude that this assignment of error was sufficient, it has to necessarily say the language he employed satisfied the language in the rule that specifically says that an assignment of error which merely states that the judgment or award is contrary to the law and the evidence is not sufficient. Unless the court can provide some explanation, justification, or rationale for why the assignment of error here satisfied that language, if you can't do it,
counsel,
I submit the rule on it is quite clear. It says the appeal must be dismissed.
Counsel, for whose benefit is that rule drawn? For yours or for ours?
Well, I guess that's sort of in the eyes of the beholder.
Let me answer it. I think it's for ours rather than yours. The issue is, does the assignment of error lay its finger on the issue that the reviewing court is going to have to decide? I can only speak for myself, but when it's an assignment of error relating to the sufficiency of the evidence, I know what to look for. And I know where to look for the absence of something.
Well, Your Honor, I would just, I don't want to just repeat my position into the ground. I think you have an explicit rule of court, which the members of the court, under the most basic rules of construction, normally are required to give effect to. And this directly contravened the explicit language that was put in this rule.
Well, no, it actually doesn't. The rule says contrary to law and evidence. So if that's all you have, I don't know if you're challenging it on a legal basis, that the jury instruction was wrong, or some other aspect of whether it's a sufficiency challenge. But we do know with this assignment of error that the defendant was challenged with the sufficiency of the evidence, and he says to each offense, so we know which offense even.
Well, I submit that when it says the judgment award is contrary to the law and the evidence is not sufficient. To me, that certainly encompasses this. The court may reach a different conclusion. I didn't really save any time
for
rebuttal.
Mr. Anderson, the dilemma for you to answer Justice Millett's question, which is a good question, is that we have dismissed scores of cases like this, and they never got here for an opinion for that reason.
Right. I did not save any time for rebuttal. I guess I should have a very quick...
Well, you can stop now and save it if you want to, what's left.
Excuse me?
You can save what's left if you wish to.
Well, I guess I should very briefly get into the issue on the merits of the abduction. It's an issue of the Court of Appeals held the evidence failed on the second element of abduction, which was lack of intent to deprive the victims of their personal liberties. Intent is like sort of finding it's an issue of fact for the finder of fact to resolve, and it's like any other finding of fact on appeal. I submit there was ample evidence here to support the trier of fact's finding that both elements were met. Just two or three bits and pieces from the evidence. First of all, the siege lasted several hours. The 911 call was at 7:22 at night. The call ended at 11:47. The only reason that the three young children were able to get out of the house after that protracted period of time was the defendant's father, Tony Sr., sort of knocked him from behind, and to the point we said, kids, go outside, and they fled outside. One of the twin daughters, who I think was 11 at the time, said she wanted to leave, but she couldn't before Tony Sr. devised a plan. That's at page 96. The other sister testified she wanted to leave but didn't feel safe and was afraid the defendant would shoot her.
Counsel, you gave us a lot of evidence about the detention. How about the intent to detain, though?
Well,
that's what the Court of Appeals had problems with.
First of all, the two elements, as Burton said, there's obviously a significant overlap, and proof of one is probative of the other. A defendant, you can assume he intended the natural probable consequences of his actions. When he engages in this violent behavior where he, among other things, threatens to kill his own children and family, of course they don't feel safe. Of course they feel like they have to lock themselves behind bedroom doors. They couldn't leave that house for several hours because of his actions. It was very predictable. Trier of fact could infer that's what he intended. And the trial judge, sitting as the trier of fact, if you read his comments, among other things, Tony Sr., after the three children were able to flee outside to safety, Tony Sr. started to walk, and he said, "You walk, I'm going to shoot you." And he finally said, "You're going to have to kill me." But the trier of fact pointed out that that comment about, "If you leave, I'm going to shoot you," meant he wanted him to stay. Again, this is the most predictable scenario. This defendant does what he does. What happened? It'd been peculiar if something other than this had happened. They locked themselves up in bedrooms trying to take refuge. It lasted several hours. It was not like this was some unexpected development. When the defendant engages in this violent behavior, including shooting a gun with threats to kill his wife both before and after the shooting of the gun, and threatens to kill the family members, it's not exactly a stretch to figure out how that's going to play out. And
you've answered your
question. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think you've answered his question. Your time's expired. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is John Hill. I have the honor of representing before this court Tony Mark Herring, Jr. On the outset, let me say to this court that I realize that both this court and the Court of Appeals has had to deal with these particular issues involving the assignments of error repeatedly over the last few years, and to the extent that I'm contributing to that, as opposed to having you all decide these cases on the merits, I apologize for adding to that this discussion. I do, however, feel that the Court of Appeals did get this particular issue right in holding that court did have jurisdiction to hear this matter despite the assignments of error being worded the way they were in the petition and the brief. The Court of Appeals relied on the Moore case, which, of course, was decided before this court changed the rules and added that specific language in regard to the assignments of error. But I think that the Court of Appeals looked at the factors in Moore and in Jay and said, everyone knew at this point what the issues were. When the Commonwealth Attorney's Office in the County of Augusta filed their reply brief, they didn't raise the issue about the assignments of error. They responded particularly to the issues raised in the defendant's brief.
Let me give you a response to why that's an inadequate response, because you're going to need to address it. The rule doesn't say that it's insufficient except in cases where we can figure out what you're talking about. And the reason why is because it's easy in some cases and it's hard in other cases, but you have to have one rule for all cases. So, for example, it may be very easy in a case to come up here and say, it's contrary to the law and evidence. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I saw it, too. But you take a bigger case, a case that has criminal fraud. You have intentional misrepresentation of a material fact that induces reliance upon another to their detriment. Now, I want to know what part of that is missing if you're challenging it. And so the dilemma is that you have maybe one case, and maybe it's easy in this case, but we have thousands of cases, and we have one rule that applies to them all.
I understand that, you know, appellate law is not a lot about the case that's being tried, but the cases that will come after that, and I appreciate that question. And so what I would point to is the fact that in this particular case, what differentiates this from maybe the others that have, as you had mentioned earlier, never made this procedure, made this status, is that we did reference in the assignment of error where in the record the objection had been made, and it is in this case, it's a very small part of the record. I think a half a page on one, a half a page on the other, where defense counsel laid out his objections to the court's ruling or his arguments to the Commonwealth's evidence. And so I really don't have a good answer to your question about what, you know, for going forward, why this rule should not be upheld in this case. But in this case, I do think that there's a strong argument to be made that the court and the Commonwealth knew what the arguments were and were able to respond to them. And that's what the Moore case, I think, held, is that if the errors are insignificant and everyone knows what the arguments are, then the case can proceed. And maybe that's the argument to be made, Justice, is that's the decision. If it's a complicated case, it's one rule. If it's not a complicated case, it's another rule.
Well, it seems to me that an argument that you could make that I haven't heard is that while the designation of where the error was preserved arguably is not a part of the assignment of error itself, but a superimposed requirement, it nonetheless points the Commonwealth as well as the court to the exact place where you think the deficiency exists. It seems to me that response on your part might have some traction.
Well, that I thought I was trying to say that, is that we referenced page 150 in the transcript, and that is where defense counsel made the argument about the sufficiency of the evidence and what particular parts of the statute that the Commonwealth had not proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And
perhaps an even better response is that your assignment of error actually references the motion to strike the Commonwealth's evidence, and then in the part that you have to include that's actually not part of the assignment of error is where in the JA we'll find the motion to strike.
And that is why I think the Finley case gives this case the opportunity to be heard, in that in the Finley case they referenced the motion to suppress, and from that point all parties knew, the court knew what the arguments were to be. And in this case, we referenced the motion to strike, and again...
Well, on the motion to strike, you didn't make a motion to strike at the conclusion of the Commonwealth's case. It wasn't made at the conclusion of all the evidence. Closing argument began, and then the motion to strike was made.
You are correct. There was no motion to strike made at the end of the Commonwealth's evidence, and it wasn't at the end of all the evidence that the defense counsel at trial did use that term, make a motion to strike the Commonwealth's evidence during the process of his argument. And we would submit that the argument made by defense counsel at the end of all the evidence was in the form of a motion to strike, even though he didn't properly set that up. And so that the record reflects, the assignment of error reflects where in the record those words were used, or that the defense counsel made the objections to any arguments to the Commonwealth's evidence, and that would allow this court and the Commonwealth to fashion their arguments in the opposite to that.
So referencing a motion to strike in the closing argument would be the equivalent of a motion to strike?
Well, this was a bench trial.
It was a bench trial.
Yeah, and we've had a case that commented on that it's okay to combine the two if you have a judge who's trying the case, but it's not okay
Correct.
If you have a juror.
Right. And this was a bench trial, and so that the trial counsel campaign. He used the term motion to strike, but it, in, as just pointed out, it was in the process of making his closing argument.
Counsel, if we have an assignment of error such as this, which may or may not be sufficient, and we have a bare-bones closing argument, motion to strike, which may or may not be sufficient, then does that not require that we go to the record and search the record for the sufficiency of the evidence if both of those things are arguably deficient?
I think just that, that you would go to the referenced area of the transcript of the record of proceedings, and if you could not discern from the counsel's argument at that point what the issues were, I think that at that point the court would have the grounds to dismiss this action, as that there at that point you would have to search through the entire record. Fortunately, in this case, the record was not very long, but I understand that there are criminal cases where the record is extremely long. In this case, however, we referenced the closing arguments. The defense counsel made a reference in the abduction charges to the statute. He stated that that the Commonwealth had not proven all of the provisions of the abduction statute. He makes a reference to the intent of the defendant, I guess obliquely, but he does state that the Commonwealth has not proven all of the provisions of the statute, in, which include the intent to detain the individuals.
Well, and you're on the merits now, right?
I was going to try to slide
into it. Yeah, I hope you are. I'm glad you're sliding into it, because I can't imagine. The whole idea is almost like the criminal concept of whether somebody's free to leave. Almost. It's not quite, but it's almost like it. If you had a gun pointed at me and you said, I think I'm going to have to kill you, I don't think I would feel free to leave. Now, if in the evidence in this case is that he said he, to his children and his father-in-law, or his actual father, it was
father,
his father,
it's his father.
I'm going to have to kill you. And they are, in fact, looking at the barrel of a gun. Now, those combinations alone would seem to me sufficient to prove abduction, certainly sufficient for a trial judge to find the intent that he have them secure and not leave. How do you respond to that?
I'm not sure that, first of all, I'm not sure that the record states that the gun was pointed at the children or his father-in-law when he made the statements.
you know, for me, all he'd have to do is have it in his hand, all right?
Well, there was a testimony that there were two guns, and that they were in various places throughout the home, sometimes in the defendant's hand, sometimes laying up against the wall, sometimes being fired. But and the statements that he made to the children and the father have a context of, you know, the police aren't going to, this is the last time you're going to see me, and no one's going to, you know, you're all going to go out in a blaze of glory type of statement. But you have to contrast that with, and the Commonwealth has the Attorney General has made the comment about the length of this, the duration of this situation. There were a number of statements throughout the time this was going on, some of them more innocuous or less innocuous than others. I think that you'd have to take that statement about, I'm going to take my life and you're never going to see me again and I'm going to take yours as well, in context of the fact that during this abduction, the children are moving throughout the house. He's allowing them to talk to the 911 operator. They're able to move from one room to the next room. He never tells them, you need to go in your room. It's Tony Herring Sr. that says, you know, there's a situation going on here. Let's get you into your room. He really does allow his wife to leave. The father-in-law says he's got a gun, you've got to leave. He goes outside, never chases her down, never goes out into their yard to look for her. The grandfather never leaves the living room. Grandfather's in the living room the entire time talking to the son. And when they leave, the grandfather says he knocks him down, but my client never makes any attempt to try to stop them from leaving. They go right out. I submit that in the broad kind of in the taking all of those facts and looking at them as opposed to just focusing on his statements about ending his life and his children's life, that he has not evidenced any intent to detain those children. His actions, and the trial court judge, you may have read this, I mean, trial court judge was correct. It was a terrible situation. You have guns and children, small children, and father. But the fact is, if you look at the statements by my client and the actions he took, they were not directed to intimidate the children into remaining in the house. They were directed at his ex-wife. I mean, his wife. That's probably his ex-wife now, but his wife at that point. They were directed at the police coming to arrest him. They were directed at...
The statements to the children and his father that I may have to kill you were directed at the wife who was under a car in the front yard and police officers who were on the 911 call?
I don't think that statement was... That statement was directed toward his children. But it was actually, Justice, when he said that, the context of it was that no one's going to be able to testify against me, you know, about this incident with my wife. But I understand the court's point, that if someone's pointing a gun at you and telling me they're going to kill you, that you're not going to start walking out the door, although Mr. Herring Sr. seemed to be able to do that at the end.
Well, the fact that the defendant may have changed his mind on that subject would be like saying that an embezzler from a bank is not guilty if he pays it back before he gets caught. And certainly that's not the law.
Counsel, let me ask you a question that I think Justice Lemons maybe hasn't gotten to yet, is going to get to. A lot of things we've talked about are detention. What is evidence of his intent to detain them?
Well,
you contend there is none. You want to discuss that?
I think I was trying to say that his actions, you know, while the Commonwealth argued that they were showed his intent to detain them, his lack of actually telling them where to go, his allowing them to speak to the 911 operator,
Let me change the question a little bit.
All right.
The Commonwealth argues that we're entitled to infer that the natural and probable consequences of his act were that his intention was to detain them. We've said in Burton you can't conflate those two things. You've got to have evidence to show those two separate elements, that they were detained and that there was an intent on the person detaining them to detain them.
And I would argue that that was not his intent, and that the facts, other than the statement about wanting to kill them, do not show that he had intent to do that. And he never stated an intent to not let them leave or to secrete them in some place in the house. And so that is part of our argument, that there is no intent. There was no intent on behalf of Mr. Herring. May have had an intent to do other things, but the intent to detain these children and his father-in-law was not one of the things.
Okay, thank you for answering my question.
Thank you.
Time to slide. Call the next case, please.